Future 2030 is an international campaign building a formidable coalition to rise to the challenge of the global climate crisis. These podcasts are part of our quest to bring together influential activists, politicians, business and thought leaders to focus on solutions to the climate crisis. Today's podcast focuses on the global policies required to achieve a circular economy. To discuss the potential for a sustainable future, we're lucky enough to be joined by Janez Potocnik, co-chair of the International Resource Panel and former EU Commissioner for the Environment. Janez, welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
Janez, you became EU Environment Commissioner in 2009 and remained in this role until 2014. During this time, you launched several integral environment initiatives, which are still being implemented today. Such was the impact of your work during this time that you've been credited by many for mainstreaming environmental concerns on the EU agenda, as well as for reconciling economic development with environmental preservation at a time when the two were deemed to be directly opposing. Looking back at your life, can you tell us what originally led you to a career in environmental policymaking?
My education, it's economics, so I've done PhD from economic modeling. And as you probably recall, my first mandate with the European Commission was in science and research. So when you join to the European Commission from a small European country, you don't have a lot of say which will be the area which will be assigned to you. But I was quite lucky because this was in a way tailor-made for me, and I really enjoyed the first mandate. But for the second mandate, I've had a bit more of negotiating power because I've been in the Commission for one term. And I really insisted a lot because it's the president who actually at the end decides who will have which portfolio. I was really insisting a lot to get the environment. And the reasons are basically twofold. The one is that I was always believing that environment, it's that protecting environment is the only responsible way to go. So I was a true believer, and that we are to a certain extent failing. And the second reason was that I also believed that if one understands right, basically environment, it's the most important economic portfolio. And I could actually share a lot of my experiences from the previous life in guiding that portfolio.
What are you most proud of during your time as EU Environment Commissioner? And what do you find the biggest challenge while you were there?
Yeah, I would mention two things which I remember very well. There are basically many, but immediately when I started with the portfolio, if you remember, that was after that climate crisis in Copenhagen. And nobody actually anymore believed in multilateralism at that time. And the first meeting, the first big travel was immediately to Nagoya, where was a CBD conference, biodiversity convention, which actually ended up quite successfully. So we adopted Aichi targets, also some other important documents. And it was a new revival of the multilateralism. And it was actually a good start, which gave me a lot of, on one hand, credibility, and on the other hand, also the energy to start believing that things are possible. But the most important thing, which I would link to my 5 years, is basically creating a new narrative and importance of resource management with environmental development. You will certainly recall that at that time, the climate area was delinked from the rest of environment. Mm-hmm. And it was, in a way, for me, before, obviously, climate was the leading part of the overall environment efforts. And for me, it was quite important to establish a kind of new narrative, which I started to build around this resource management and connectivity to economic activities so that environmental story is better understood not only in among environment community, but also by the rest of the society, in particular by those dealing with the economics. This ended with the circular economy package in 2014, which, by the way, if I can anecdotically say, you have not mentioned at the beginning, because many have forgotten that actually the circular economy started during the Barroso's commission, because the new commission, it was in the Juncker's commission, the first thing which they have done is they have removed it from their agenda. But then on the basis of a fierce reaction of the many stakeholders who actually participating in building the circular economy story, together with me, they were in a way forced to put it back on the agenda. And at the end of their mandate, it actually proved to be the most successful idea, which a lot of goodwill around. So the biggest challenge, probably I would say, profiling this responsible, sustainable behavior in relation to environment as being economically attractive, because many stranded assets, investments, interests are there. But frankly, at the end of the mandate, I was quite positively surprised how many people actually understood that those two things needs to go hand in hand, or we will have a major problem. By the way, we have a major problem, and the reason that they started to understand it exactly that.
Can you explain what this circular economy is and how it's different to a linear economy?
Sure. Linear economy, simply, it's using virgin natural resources, producing then products, services, and then, of course, at the end of the process, you have waste, which you treat as waste, as a problem, you throw them away and you start searching for new virgin resources, digging deeper and causing even more problems. It's basically a kind of linear way of treating all natural resources. While the circular economy, it's in the first place how to use a few virgin resources, as few as possible, but also keep various types of resources in production and consumption cycle as long as possible, and also keep their value as high as possible, because this is an economic incentive that actually it's driving the whole system ahead. So in that you have to respect the hierarchy. So in the first place, reducing, then maintaining, reusing, redistributing, refurbishing, remanufacturing, recycling. So many people have actually seen recycling as circularity. But if I can put it bluntly, recycling is the worst of the good. So you recycle, you have already used the resources. Not that it's not needed, on the contrary, it's very much needed. But we have to focus on the other things. There are basically three ways how Ellen MacArthur Foundation has designed and defined the circular economy. First, preserve and enhance natural capital by controlling finite stocks and balancing renewable resource flows. Second, optimize resource yields by circulating products, components, materials in use at the highest utility at all the times in both technical and biological cycles. And third, foster system effectiveness by revealing and designing out negative externalities. But circular economy, it's not a new concept. It's probably the oldest concept on the earth, because the whole nature is actually organized in a circular way. So nothing is lost. Everything has its purpose.
Now, we are conducting this interview both sat in our own homes because of the coronavirus outbreak and COVID-19. What's your view of the way things are going? Can we bring in coronavirus? Is it going to push us back a number of years on things, or can we use it in the environment movement to sit back and say, look, we need to work with nature here?
So the lesson for me, it's pretty clear. We are living in a more interconnected and interrelated world than ever. So we are basically the first generation who is living on a planetary, social, ecological planetary scope. And we are more fragile than ever. And very likely, due to the side effects which we now see, it is highly likely that the probability of health outbreaks like we are facing currently, or the probability of extreme weather events like we are seeing coming with the climate crisis, that this will increase. If this is very likely, an intelligent and only reasonable response to that would be that in the first place, we start considering and reconsidering the way how we manage risks, be it locally or be it globally. I think that's the most important lesson which we have learned. how to prepare to that things, and how to basically equip ourselves to avoid that the things were getting worse. On the European level, we have in our treaties so-called precautionary principle, which frankly nobody actually knows how to implement it in the practice. But of course, maybe stepping a bit more seriously on how to implement it in the, or discussing how to implement that in the practice, would actually not be so bad. And in the times like we are living through now, it's actually proving that precautionary principle can save the jobs and it can even save the lives. So it's a bit revaluing our values. And I sincerely hope that the understanding will not be the opposite. While at the beginning, while currently we have to focus, of course, immediately on how to save the jobs, how to save the companies. But while we are focusing on that to prevent that the economic ship would sink, we also have to take care that that the compass of the ship still is going in the same direction. And this direction was very nicely set it by the current European Commission with the Green Deal proposal.
Well, that brings me nicely on to your current role as chair of the International Resource Panel, which was launched by the United Nations Environment Programme in 2007 to build and share the knowledge needed to improve our use of resources worldwide. Can you tell us a little more about the work of the IRP and what it hopes to achieve?
Yeah, very quickly, IRP is a kind of a sister organization of organizations which you know better, like IPCC, which is dealing with the climate change, IPBS, which is dealing with the biodiversity challenges, and it's a kind of science policy interface where we try to create a critical mass of science which could hardly be disregarded by anybody, including the policymakers. So we have a lot of people from all parts of the world which are working in all the areas, all the aspects of resource management. When I say natural resources, the areas which we are covering are land, water, biomass, fossil fuels, metals, non-metallic minerals. We have issued more than 20 reports. And the last year, we issued the Global Resource Outlook 2019, which was the first comprehensive overview of resource management. In short, the panel's mission is to provide independent, coherent, and authoritative scientific assessment of policy relevance on the sustainable use of natural resources, and in particular, their environmental impacts over the full life cycle, and to contribute to a better understanding of how to decouple economic growth from environmental degradation. There are many ways how you can do it, but one of the best instruments for that is actually the one which we mentioned before, that's the circular economy.
So in very much layman's terms, you're saying there that really it's very difficult to manage the environment unless we link it very closely to economics.
Yeah, it's very difficult because in essence, When we talk, for example, about climate change, when we talk about biodiversity loss, pollution, and so on, we basically talk about the effects. We talk about the state and impact. But if you want to really deal seriously with those states, which we have to deal with, you have to go back to the drivers and pressures. And the drivers and pressures are linked to humans and human activity. And human activity is called, as you know, economics. Mm-hmm. So the link between those two poles actually goes through the natural resource use. Because on one hand, natural resources are quite fundamental in designing the products, in delivering the services, in the profits, and so on. So in economic story, but the irrational use and irresponsible use of those resources is actually causing the side effects, which we see in climate change, biodiversity loss, pollution, and so on. Mm. So we try to connect those two stories with a bridge which goes through natural resource management.
You just spoke there about your kind of sister organization, the IPCC, which came out with a study 2 years ago now that really woke a lot of people up, saying that there are just 12 years in which to keep climate change within 1.5 degrees of 1990 levels. And a lot of people around the world, including groups such as Extinction Rebellion and Greta Thunberg, said, well, look, if you look at this report and if you accept the findings of this report, we're just not going fast enough. I know that you've done a very popular TED talk talking about the amount of resources we're on in line to use by 2050, but this IPCC report was talking about 2030. Are we actually moving fast enough? Because some of the criticisms are that politicians are great at talking, but they're just not moving as quickly as their studies are saying that they should be moving.
Yeah, the short answer is we are not moving fast enough. On the other hand, awareness of that this is necessary, it's increasing. But if we return for a second to the crisis which we are going through currently, what you are seeing is that if we consider that as that challenge as a immediate and serious, so if we consider it in that way, we can act very quickly. We can pull together a lot of resources. We can deal, I would not say in a coordinated way, but very much in the same direction and in the same way. And we can do a lot. So it's really the question, do we understand the urgency? And in this case, we obviously understand the urgency and we are doing that. So the lack of a real response when it comes to climate crisis, when it comes to environmental crisis, it's obviously showing that the urgency is not yet well understood, or we would be acting in a bit different way than we are acting. So I'm not saying that on the contrary. I think that the level of awareness is growing. It's growing everywhere. It's growing in policy, political cycles. It's growing also in the private sector. And one very good example is the recently proposed Green Deal on the side of the European Commission. And it's a clear sign that the understanding also on the high political levels has reached the level that this is pretty much fundamental direction which we have to go if we want to sustain, not because at the end it's never about the planet, it's always about us, if we want to sustain the quality of life and if we want to avoid some of the side effects which we are currently already quite visually seeing coming and living among us. So it's the urgency indeed which needs to be strengthened and better understood.
And if we don't move fast enough, what does the world look like if we carry on our current trajectory? Can you paint us a kind of picture of what that might look like?
Yeah, it's actually, if I look it through the resource management, then basically, since we have just last year released the Global Resource Outlook, which I already mentioned, for the last 50 years, the data are pretty simple. Global resource use has more than tripled since 1970. And global material demand per capita has almost doubled, which means that the majority of that tripling can actually be connected to economics, the rest to the population growth. But if we look to the modeling which we have done, according to our results, the modeling was done till 2060, global material extraction would more than double, agricultural land would increase for approximately 20%, forests would go down by 10%, natural habitats down by 20%, greenhouse gases by up almost 40%. This, as you know, different groups are making different kind of models. For example, OECD model was giving a bit different results. But in essence, the message coming from all those models is pretty same. They are telling us the same story. So change is urgent. The way how we are currently doing cannot continue. And we have to redesign our economic model if we want that the side effects will actually not be bigger than the value which we are creating with our economic activity.
And what can ordinary individuals do if they're worried about this? What are some of the things that they can do?
First of all, we should request that we are well informed. So For me, what is most important is that we have transparency, traceability in various products, and digitalization, and the level which we have reached is giving us enormous opportunities that we can better inform the consumers. So, of course, in many cases, consumers should be a bit less, if I can use that word, manipulated, because a lot of commercials which we are seeing on our screens are simply pure manipulation. Also, a lot of labeling which we are seeing, it's quite a lot of proliferation of the labeling. We would need to have labeling which is more certified, or in which we have better trust, because with that proliferation and the greenwashing which we see, consumer is not very much supported. So what we consumers should do is insisting on that we are well equipped, but then our responsibility as individuals, it's of course that we behave and act responsibly.
So that's consuming better choices in consumption. Do you think people need to consume less? And in terms of consuming less, how does that work with economic growth? It'd be great to hear from someone who's an economist saying how you can grow the economy while consuming less.
There are many cases where we could consume the things more responsibly, less if you want. But if you would approach to a consumer with a kind of red flag, now you have to fundamentally change your behavior, and fundamentally you have to rethink the way the things, everything, because I think that's not really the thing which will in practice work. But there are possibilities through which you can approach to any consumer. I think everything needs to start a bit with the philosophy, which is we need mobility, we don't need cars. We need light, we don't need light bulbs. We need fresh and cool food, we don't need refrigerator. We need to sit, we don't need chair. So basically, we don't need pesticides, we need healthy and protected plants. So if you go that way, if you think that way, if you go to the end of the human needs, then you provide some of those needs in a different way. For example, if somebody would be selling me the light bulb, if it would be selling me contract of the year of a light, what is the difference? For me as a consumer, nothing. Actually, my life is easier, because I don't need to think where I will buy the light bulb. Is it the right one? When it will be at the end of life broken, where I have to dispose it? Because we all know that we shouldn't put it into the regular bin, but we have to dispose it carefully. And this is a problem. So for me as a consumer, that's easier. What does it happen for the producer? If producer is selling you the light bulb, the number of light bulbs are actually his profit. If it's selling you the light, the number of the light bulbs he or she is using is his cost. So suddenly it is incentivized to sell you or to produce, and inbuilt in the service which it's giving to you, less light bulbs, which saves the resources. It's a model which is incentivizing producer in a different way. The same story I can explain with mobility. So if you would have the car parked in 2 minutes in the city in front of your house, if you would be in need, you would not even dream about having your own car, because your own car is at the end just bringing you a lot of the problems, and it's extremely costly thing which you have. So alternatives. Think about alternatives, different ways how to fulfill our needs. And that's the best way how actually you can go. And there are many systems through which this kind of logic could be introduced.
Well, that's good to hear, because that's all sharing economy kind of ideas and the idea of moving away from ownership. And
higher utilization, exactly. Yeah. Higher utilization. So we have underutilization of all the car fleet. We have underutilization of our offices, of our apartments. We have underutilization of the clothes which we are wearing. So there are many things which are existing but are underutilized.
That brings us on to quickfire round. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
Yeah, okay. Just in one sentence, because I know we are at the end. So even if the things looks quite worrying, and even if sometimes we see more gloom and doom, it's essential to stay positive and optimistic. And the reason for that is very simple. Optimists live much better and longer.
And you pointed out earlier that lots of consumers really struggle to be able to see the difference between greenwash and other things. What is the simplest thing any one person can do to be part of the solution to the big problems we face today?
Since I was for a long time in policy making, don't wait for the leaders, be the leaders. So be the leaders on whatever you do, on whatever level, personal, local, in your life, and try to be proactive and try to deliver the answers and not wait for the answers.
Janez Potocnik in Brussels, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, it was a pleasure.
You were listening there to John Higginson, founder of Nature 2030, interviewing Janez Potocnik, former European Commissioner for the Environment. Nature 2030 is a campaign run by Higginson Strategy, which supports governing bodies, NGOs, charities, companies, and individuals, all within the business of making the world a better place. To hear more about our work or get involved with our positive campaigns, go to higginsonstrategy.com.